Hello and welcome to this discussing episode. And today we're going to be having a chat about a proper new interlude of The World and the Child, otherwise called Mundaset Infants. And it showeth of the estate of childhood and manhood. This is a play that we are in the process at the moment of recording this of editing. It has all been recorded. It was one of our sort of bonus projects. And the reason why it's a bonus project is a talking point for later in this discussion. Yeah, it's something that's in the edit as I record this. But as you listen to this, it will already have been edited for most of you listening. And in fact, will be on its way to you within probably a few weeks. You should have already had all the wonderful spoilers episodes discussing the rough cut, and the full cast audio adaptation will be coming to your ears shortly. But before we get to that, I have a wonderful guest to chat with me about the play and its context. So, my special guest, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Hello, I am still, since we last met, Greg Walker, still working at the University of Edinburgh. And my purpose in life, should I choose to accept it, I think, is to make early drama acceptable to the polite classes. So I'm writing a book at the moment about early morality plays and why we may have got them all wrong in the past, we being scholars rather than actors. And one of the plays I'm thinking about is The World and the Child. So looking forward to hearing about the production in particular, if you can give some spoilers during the conversation.
Yes, absolutely I can. Yes, it's nice for us not to be talking about John Heywood. We've done rather a lot of chatting about John Heywood. And that's not that I've turned my back on him, but, you know,
there can't have too much Heywood is my view, but yeah. Sometimes perhaps leave him aside for a bit.
Yes, it will mix things up a little bit. Yes, it's lovely to have you back on the pod, and let's get a bit of background. So this is described here as a proper new interlude. It was new once, and it's described as an interlude. It's also described as a morality play. In the context of when did this play come about, which is an open question to a degree. We know when it was at one point printed. But do we know, yeah, some background of the kind of universe that this play would have come into?
Yes. I mean, as you say, there are so many questions for which we don't have definitive answers that it becomes a really interesting play to talk about. It is a morality play, although it's in many ways, which I'm sure we'll discuss, not typical. It's announced as a new play, a new interlude in, am I right in remembering, 1522?
I believe that was the printing that we have, yes.
Yeah. So, but then again, they're never going to say, here is a rather old hat piece of production that you're all familiar with. So most of them tended to be advertised in those terms, in terms of novelty and excitement and that odd tragical mirth mixture of the instructive and the entertaining. This one, as we're kind of hinting at, was published, it was printed. So in that respect, it's different to some of the earlier canonical morality plays like The Castle of Perseverance or Mankind, which we only have really in manuscript. So it's a little bit odd in that sense. Without spoiling too much, the casting requirements are quite interesting and odd as well. But it is, to some degree, part of that, as you say, the universe of the morality play. It's more like a morality play than the Heywood plays we've discussed in the past. It's got that kind of central protagonist who in some ways represents humankind. I mean, this one is the child of the play who grows, again, spoiler, I'm afraid, into something rather more manly and then something rather more aged during the, as we watch.
The play comes with this really helpful, unhelpful cast list that lists, you know, we've got Mundus, infants, wanton, lust and liking, manhood, conscience, folly, perseverance and age, of which most of those are the same person.
Yes,
not all of them are. Some of them are people he talks to, but they're all listed as different names. And the central character's name keeps changing during the script. So that's
he
helpful.
Grows up before our eyes, yes. Mm.
We have this play that is printed. It's lumped together with explicitly medieval texts. Of course, the printing we have is early Tudor. And it's sort of caught between two worlds, between what's coming and what's gone before. It is a funny sort of mishmash of a text in that sense. It's very small in scale. It potentially could be doubled, arguably, to two. I would argue there is an issue with it doubling it,
yes,
down to two. But you can sort of make it work.
That was going to be one of my questions. Did you swap the roles or did you carry on with the through role for the main guy?
For this version, we kept the main guy was well, in this instance, for budgetary reasons, was me. I was available to do it. Yes, yeah, so the growing up child is the same actor throughout. However, we did do on the YouTube channel, we did a reading where we had different actors playing throughout. So you can expand the cast considerably further so that all of those people are different people. And that's one of those questions. Is that a representation of the original practice? Is that what the script was doing? Or is it just they just changed the name? Because that's also a convention you have with scripts where the name of a character will change if their status changes. So a prince will become a king in the dramatis personae and in the speech prefixes. So it's a little jubbly.
I mean, I'm quite persuaded by the modern editors, Peter Happe and whoever else it was, he said, casting his eyes over Clifford Davidson, who suggests it does work very well with one actor right up until very close to the end when you need a really quick costume change if one character is going to go off as whoever it is and come back on as Perseverance. Is that what I mean?
Yes. Well, it's the doubling of if you do it with two actors and the other actors around him are the same person, then there is a doubling clash at the end. Conscience says, I'm going to go off and find Perseverance, and then a Perseverance immediately comes on stage. Yeah. So if that part is doubled, there's a problem.
Yeah, because there are no intervening song and dance lines to sort of busk while he does that.
Yes.
So the interesting suggestion is that for that role only, the guy who comes, they both go off and then they come back, or rather the guy who's been playing the Mundus, the humankind character, suddenly is played by the other actor. Interesting. I mean, I'd like to see that tried. I mean, if there are sort of costuming choices made that retain a kind of through story while the character is aging, I guess you could come on in the child jumper, albeit with different hair and totter about a bit and be age, and we would be none the wiser. But
I think it's fine if the central character, who, you know, he's got so many names, it's difficult to know which one we go for. But the humanity figure, if that character changes constantly through the play and there is a visual signifier to show how you pass the baton on, I don't have a problem with that. Yeah. If it only happens at the end once, then I have a problem with it because I find it A, untidy, and B, I think there's room for the audience being confused. I mean, you could put some music in. There's no mention of music in the text. You know, there are ways that maybe we don't have information from this script that we have that is confusing us as to what's going on, that there might be just missing data, there might be missing bits. I mean, is this the complete script as it was originally formulated is one of those big questions. That's we've sort of dived, we've dived a bit too deep into this text already, actually.
Oh, already.
Yeah, because it has a very choppy verse style. It feels like there's something weird may have gone on there. That, you know, sometimes it's very regular and it feels like it's very controlled, and then it changes tone and changes shape in odd ways that are not wholly explicable.
I mean, I don't know. Well, obviously, you can tell me the answer to this, but despite various critical accounts saying, you know, it doesn't look like an acting script. It doesn't look like it was born out of performance. It does seem to me to be eminently performable. I mean, it's the lines themselves kind of cry out for how the role, particularly of the child and the young man, should be performed. You know, it's incredibly active and physical.
I would argue very much that it's an acting script, partly because it's a bit of a mess. I mean, there is something about what happens to a script if you are, say, if you're in a modern theatre context, if you're, say, you've got a two-hander and you're taking it on the road and you do a month at the Edinburgh Festival, as I have done, the script you went in with is very different to the script you come out with. And the marking up of that script as it changes is a bit erratic. I remember trying to revive a show that we did in Edinburgh about 6 to 9 months after we did it. And we were trying to rehearse from the original script and we went, this isn't the show we were doing. And so in that sense, a certain untidiness speaks of actual use rather than against it, actually. And it's perfectly performable. I mean, I do it with three actors, probably, rather than two, so that the two interlocutors who talk to our central figure get a chance to go off, change costume in a more sensible fashion, and that would work perfectly well. But you could use mask as well. You could do all sorts of things to even out the gaps in the service to make it function. But in that sense, the reason why it appeals, the reason why we've done it, it wasn't voted for explicitly by our patrons. It was one that we just sort of sneaked in. We were recording some other stuff, and I said to an actor, "Here, you can read Folly. There you go." And then I filled in the gaps with the central figure, because it is very, it's short. It's got a small cast. It's very easy to stage in so many ways.
And it's very honest, I think. I mean, the fact that, you know, the costume changes occur in front of us. You know, here I give you this garment when the child transfers from infancy into teenagerhood, and then...
"These garments gay I give to thee, and also I give to thee a name, and clep thee wanton in every game."
And there's another one as he becomes manhood mighty or whatever it is. It's showing its homework, the play. It's one of those where everyone's on stage in roll top black jumpers taking on the role as we see them, I think.
And we've got this, you know, we've got a central throne / chair, depending on how elaborate you want to go. And that's the image that's the frontispiece that we you know. And you've always got to be a bit careful about those kind of images, that they're probably generic woodcuts. But this image of the world, and this is where we probably should explain the plot a bit to the listeners at home, it's the image of the world. And the world is this ambiguous figure, in a sense of the world is something that you need to live in, but it's also full of wickedness and temptation. And the world takes in the child and brings it up in these stages of life as the child rapidly grows up in front of him, and then he's sent off into the world, having sworn allegiance to the seven deadly sins, who may or may not appear physically on stage as well, depending on how big you want that staging to be. There's an ambiguity there in the text. And then he goes through the usual morality play tradition of renouncing wickedness, being tempted again by some other means, falling, and then in age, repentance and the road to repentance and heaven, with a little bit of sermonizing that may or may not go on slightly too long, depending on your point of view. Just thought we'd tell the listeners what the plot of the story is. So we have this figure of Mundus, the world, who has a throne, this big central chair, who, I'd say, makes his boast in a very traditional way at the beginning. But the world isn't completely... I'm not sure that the world is a wholly evil character per se. It is this problem of the world, which isn't heaven and therefore is inherently sinly, as it were.
Yes, I mean, that's the paradox in a way that all these morality plays deal with one way or another, is that, you know, the world is both the snare and one of the great triad of the world, the flesh and the devil, are clearly not good things with capital letters. But the world is also the arena in which you prove your virtue and your faith and your belief. And it's the road you must travel in order both to grow up and to eventually prove yourself and become saved, if that's what's going to happen. So it is, you know, it is, as they say, what it is. You can't negotiate. You do negotiate with the world, but in the end, you have to be prepared to leave it. And what a lot of these plays do is suggest that that's not always an entirely moral question, because sometimes the world is inviting you to do reasonable things like grow up and become strong and intelligent and learn things and interact with your neighbours. And in order to do that, you probably need some income in order to give alms to the poor. And so the world is always there saying, come on, here's some money, here's a new costume, here's a job.
"Now, fair child, I grant thee thine asking. I will thee find while thou art young, so thou wilt be obedient to my bidding."
It has a number of faces, and in this particular play, as you're suggesting, I think the world is multifaceted, and it's a single role, and it is brilliantly symbolised simply by someone sitting in that chair. And thrones are a huge feature of so many of the morality plays. And, you know, it's so simple and yet so complex. I mean, there's a point at which it looks as if the child character, as a man, sits in that chair.
Mm.
And obviously, symbolically, that's his attempt to usurp the world, to claim the world's power on one level, but also a kind of indication that he's been absorbed within the world's clutches. But it's just a guy sitting down as well.
Mm.
And I think it's brilliant that at the moment, for the first time in the whole play, he's stationary. And that's when conscience comes in and says, now, wait a minute. You know, it's kind of very physical as well.
Yeah, and so simple. This is being written at the time when mystery plays are very, are still up and about and out in the world. Biblical drama is alive and well, and it's reminding me very much of the first play of the Chester cycle, where what is the scene? It is God says, "Do not sit in my chair," and God, I'm just going off for a tea break, and Lucifer's there going, "I think I'm going to sit in your chair," and it's the same sort of game in a sense. I mean,
behold, signors on every side, and unto me you cast your eye. I charge you, angels in this tide, behold and see what I do mean. Above great God, I will me guide and set myself here as I ween. I am peerless and prince of pride, for God himself shines not so sheen. Here will I sit now in his stead to exalt myself in this same sea. Behold my body, both hands and head. The might of God is marked in me. All angels.
The world doesn't say, don't sit in my chair. There's an implicit, almost invitation for him to do so. But that image is so similar and probably is replicated in other cycles that we don't necessarily have and other performances. So I think it's a visual thing that the audience is invited to understand.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, you know, the two great commandments, whatever you do, don't eat that apple. And whatever you do, don't sit in that chair.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're just, it's the big red button marked, don't press me. Of course, they're going to sit in the chair. Of course, they're going to eat the apple. And as soon as you see a vacant chair on stage, those associations are there, I think. And so is he, isn't he, is he? Oh, he has, yes. Oh, he's sat in it. What's going to happen? So I think there's a kind of slight shock almost. Although on the one hand, it reinforces that model. It's not something terrible that comes in. It's conscience and says, here's what you need to think about. So it's one step ahead of the audience all the time, but it's assuming the audience is keeping up.
It's also just in staging terms, it's very simple. You're saying that the world is basically static, and that leaves the actor playing initially the child who grows up very, very fast, to have this tour de force, as on stage he literally grows up through a series of speeches, and the world, as say, clothes him. He turns up basically poor and naked into the world, and he is given clothes, and he is given a series of different names. He becomes wanton, and he's told to go away again and come back, and he gets these lovely little speeches to the audience where he's talking about playing and the games he's playing and the stuff he's doing. So it's giving you opportunities for props as well, because he might have a spinning top and he might have other things that he can be doing, and it's this connection with the audience as well. And there's always that slight question: does the world nip off? Do they close a curtain or something, or does he just sit there watching him as time passes? Because they say, you know, come back in 7 years, come back in seven, you know, or however many years for each transition occurs.
And there's a great one when 7 years occurs just as he crosses the stage to the chair. And he says, you know, 14 years have gone. No, it's 19, isn't it? He said 19 years have come and gone. And then he arrives at the foot of the chair and says, well, that's 21 years done then. And it's that kind of incredible acceleration. But I mean, it's such a gift for an actor, I think, you know, that when it's not entirely clear to me, but it does look at least as if there is some representation of the embryo in the womb, because he says, you know, I am a child, as you may see. And then he talks about being twice. He talks about being within his mother, being kept for 40 weeks or whatever it is. And then he comes he emerges into the world, and then he says, "And now I'm marching towards death." And you know, you can almost imagine, you know, how do you, does he mime being born? And then there's all this really exciting stuff about, I am a child, as you may see. Here is my hoop, my spinning top, my the stick with which I hit my friends and then hop away and stick my tongue after them.
Yes.
Wanton is my name. I can many a quaint game. Lo, my top I drive insane. See how it turneth round. I can with my scourge stick my fellow upon the head hit, and lightly from him make a skip and blear on him my tongue.
It's a bravura piece of writing. So how anyone could think it was just a text to be read?
No, it is full of visual action. It is full of business. It is full of inferred cues. And I think it's even more apparent later on as well. But let's stick chronologically while we can. So we've got also that he's introduced to the seven deadly sins, who are these kings. Mm. He's supposed to swear fealty to King of Pride, King of Envy, King of Wrath, etc. But this question: are they supposed to be figures who are standing there, or are they, or do you just pick someone out from the audience? This is the king of. This is how that's how I do it. Frankly, I give people paper hats, and get them to stand up and say you swear fealty to them, because again, theatre is so interactive in the medieval world. You know, even more so than later in the early modern, where you know, when buildings start getting in the way. Here they're constantly moving the audience around to the way, or telling them to get out. There isn't enough room for my exit, my entrance. Make room. This room is too small for us to be doing this play, etc. So it feels like it's constantly inviting the audience to be part of the event on some level.
And you're surely going to, I mean, it's another gift, isn't it? I mean, in any crowd, you're going to get someone that you might legitimately point out as lechery, and another one who looks a little bit slothful, and then, oh, who's going to be gluttony? Let's guess. Mm. And so it's going to get a laugh every single choice you make.
So he grows up, he's given a new costume, he's become manhood, been dubbed a knight. So the world has a sword. And is it a question of, does the world give manhood the sword afterwards? It's like, you know, because he does have a sword fight later on. So it feels like there's almost a handing over of power. So if, you know, sitting down in the seat of the world, it is as much a handing over of the world to him, and this symbolic act.
And of course, this is when he started to talk like the world was talking at the beginning, the alliterative boasting and the endlessly funny to a late medieval audience list of countries that implausibly he has campaigned in,
yes,
and subdued to his imperial majesty, despite the fact he's just got this single sword and a rusty breastplate, presumably. So yeah, I mean, it's the language is shifting alongside the aspirations of a child. You know, there's that eager look at me as a child, and then it's a much more kind of cynical, boastful, professional wrestler's look at me, no one in this room is as brave as I am, he says.
Yes,
and throwing down the gauntlet to the audience to shout and jeer at him.
Yeah, and that was one of the interesting challenges for the audio version. I decided to sort of go against the text a bit with Mundus, actually, to make Mundus rather than a boast, more of a quieter, softer voice. Partly because I think, you know, we're going to stage this one at some point relatively soon, because, as I say, it's cheap, and therefore it's highly probable. And so I sort of was happy to go against the text a bit. But when it comes to that handing over, those two speeches are so similar, and they're doing such similar things, that handover from the world to him is so clear. And it's got to be big when he's doing, you know, how he talks about how much he loves the King of Pride and the King of Lechery, and, you know, how they're good masters to him. And of course, that's the cue. That's the pride. That is the pride that brings in conscience. And of course, it's a morality play. We've got allegorical figures aplenty popping in. So we just don't just have representations of the world. We have conscience, or Christian conscience, shall we say, more specifically.
Clear. He's got several names as well, isn't he?
Yeah. And, you know, he's the killjoy who turns up.
Well, I'm going to stick my neck out and say, he's, as consciences go, he's the good uncle, I think. He's not, I mean, when you actually boil down to what it is he's saying, yeah, you can have a good time in the world if you want, but just keep your eyes on the bigger prize and don't do anything too excessive.
He doesn't hector. What he does, what's quite interesting, is he sort of tricks a wanton in manhood, rather, by this point, into rejecting the various sins, the various kings that he's sworn fealty to. And it's like he's also an education. I think he's almost a proper education at this, in the sense that he's been following, he's been playing, he's been fighting, but I don't think he's had an education yet. And I think conscience represents some learning of what actually is beyond the world in that sense.
And he's to go back to the theme we were addressing earlier, he's a pretty worldly conscience, isn't he? I mean, he's described as a friar and a flattering friar, dismissively. And obviously, in kind of Erasmian early 16th century terms, friars are suspect. But this one is fairly well-intentioned, but not without his kind of subtleties, as you say. I mean, he says, they go through the seven deadly sins one by one for the first six. And he says, nope, can't be proud, can't be this, can't be that. Then he gets to covetous. He says, well, actually, you can be covetous. And that's when the manhood says, oh, well, maybe there's something in this for me then. And then he persuades him that it's covetousness for Christ that he needs to. You think, oh, he's got him.
Yeah. Thou thee, from six kings thou hast counselled me, but that day shall thou never see to counsel me from covetise.
No, sir, I will not you from covetise bring, for covetise I cleep a king. Sir, covetise in good doing is good in all wise. But, Sir Knight, will ye do after me, and covetise your king shall be?
Yea, sir, my troth I plight to thee, that I will work at thy will.
Manhood, will ye by this word stand?
Yea, conscience, hear my hand, I will never from it fang, neither loud ni still.
Manhood, ye must love God above all thing. His name in idleness ye may not ming. Keep your holy day from worldly doing. Your father and mother worship I. Covet ye to slay no man, nay, do no lechery with no woman. For Christ's commandments are full sweet and full necessary to all men.
What, conscience? Is this thy covetise?
Yea, manhood, in all wise, and covet to Christ's service, both to matins
and as you say, he does say you can have fun. Fun is okay. You're allowed to have a bit of fun, just not too much.
Nice clothes. You can eat well.
Yeah.
You can have the odd drink, and you can party as much as you like, as long as you know when to stop. And I can, you know, sign me up for that kind of rigorous Christianity any day. I think it's when you compare him to some of the virtue figures in other moralities, it's quite a, you know, attractive portfolio he's offering, isn't it?
Yes, you often get these hectoring figures who sort of are wheeled on like, you know, shouting cardboard cutouts. Whereas this guy
always tell you what the last judgment is going to be like and what your soul is going to be doing and how awful it's going to be. Whereas this guy says, well, you know, we all know how this goes, but you can, there are clauses, there are loopholes, we can go through it, and in the end, stick with me and you'll be fine. But of course, oh, he doesn't.
Yeah, he basically says, look, don't go around with folly.
Yeah, it's like,
beware folly and shame, and he leaves. This is that sort of double dip quality to these plays, which is, you know, you've been taught the right lessons and then you still fall anyway. And so he's sort of ruminating. Yes, I will be a good person. I will do good things. Oh, who's this guy? And then folly turns up and tricks him again with a little bit of sophistry.
He's a lawyer, of course.
Yeah. Now I have a little bit of an issue with the text of folly, which is he comes on and it's not really wholly clear what the hell he's saying or what's going on for the first page. It's really tricky stuff to really make land. Yeah, I really struggled with that. Pretty much up until they actually go into a contest of buckler and fencing, that first exchange is really tricksy, and it seems slightly different, and it's like, what does Folly even look like in terms of his appearance? Is he on his uppers, or is he being disingenuous and actually looking fabulous, as it were?
And he scratches his ass, doesn't he, at a particular point, which suggests the disreputable and the ragged.
You know, I do but claw mine ass, sir, by your leave. And it's a sort of...
which I love. I mean, by your leave is very good.
I think it's one that will be easier to make work physically. I think this is a very, beyond the little bit of sword fighting that goes on, I think the physicality makes such a difference, whereas I think that's where we're on the back foot for an audio, where sort of it's when you've got witty wordplay and you're not quite sure what the aim of the witty wordplay is. I sort of struggled with this.
I mean, I suppose in the very first few lines are establishing him for what he is. You know, he does that, I'm a bit flighty, I'm a bit, whoa, I'm a bit this and that. And we say, right, okay, that's roughly the draw you've been drawn from. And then we have to say, well, what kind of thing is he? But you're right, he's not a, you know, if someone came on describing himself as Folly, you might expect someone in fool's costume, but that's clearly not what he is.
No.
And he's not a kind of obviously kind of bragging courtier sort of Folly. I always think of him slightly Dickensian, you know, with a slightly shabby top hat, a bit sort of Artful Dodgerish. And, you know, sure enough, he takes him off to Holborn and London and the stews to have a good time. I mean, again, forgive me for speculating horribly, but I mean, I think this is written by someone who really trusts the actors because they possibly are an actor themselves. And so knows that, you know, this is where Bill does his Folly shtick, and we can rely on him to do a kind of sinful version of what manhood actor was doing when he was a child, just sort of showing his skills for the admiration of the audience.
And we get lots of, as I say, we mentioned the stews, you know, locations. We get London Bridge pops in, taverns. We get all the street life of naughtiness, shall we say. The naughtiness of the city.
It does seem to me to be particular. I mean, a lot of the scholarship on the play wants it to be provincial. You know, it's sort of generic, old London is a bad place, so he has to mention London. But actually, there's a sort of affectionate knowledge of London.
But, sir, in London is my chief dwelling.
In London? Where, if a man the sort?
Sir, in Holborn. I was forth brought, and with the courtiers I am betaught. To Westminster I used to went.
Hark, fellow, why dost thou to Westminster draw?
For I am a servant of the law. Covetise is mine own fellow. We twain plead for the king and poor men that come from upland. We will take their matter in hand, be it right or be it wrong. Their thrift with us shall wend.
Now here, fellow, I pray thee, whither wendest thou then?
By my faith, sir, into London I ran to the taverns to drink the wine, and then to the inns I took the way, and there I was not welcome to the ostler, but I was welcome to the fair tapster, and to all the household I was right dear, for I have dwelled with her many a day.
Sort of affectionate knowledge of London in some of these lines, which makes me think it's, you know, it's written by and probably for people who are actually quite familiar with what the South Bank looks like and what Holborn looks like, and, you know, having a street full of lawyers, or worse, a pub full of lawyers, is inevitably going to go badly. And
It does speak of a sort of later city comedy in that sense. You know, it feels like the geography is right. And known, more importantly, possibly in the biblical sense. So yes, he tricks manhood with this this whole thing of this technical issue of, you know, I'm supposed to avoid folly and shame, and he says, well, I'm going to take off this cloak of shame. There it goes. I'm just folly. You can stick with me.
And interestingly, would you hold this for me? And so he then becomes shame.
Yes. And again, it's this symbolic moving of clothing to represent where you are. And he becomes shame himself in that sense, or he's shamed. And yeah, he goes off to seek folly and have a good time by completely ignoring Conscience. I love that moment. Conscience comes in and goes, "Hi, mate." And he goes, "No, I'm somebody else. I don't know who you are." And he just totally tries to blank him.
But I mean, that again is it's you know, it's not a one-off in that it's clearly thought through, because when they first met, they were at cross purposes as well. I mean, Conscience comes on and says, "Mankind ignores me and rejects me," and then on comes Mankind, and he kind of leaves and wants to push past him, and Mankind says, "Who are you?" He says, "Oh, excuse me, I've got to go." And he says, and then they have this, "Oh, you're humanity, are you?" And, "Ah, you're Conscience." And then they start talking. And so they miss each other again. It's really great. I mean, I love the way it's all kind of actually quite nicely tied together. You know, you get rhymes, you get echoes of, if something happens in the first half, it's going to happen again later on.
And so we are left with this awkward crossover bridge issue between Conscience's exit and Perseverance's entrance, which could be solved actually by maybe moving some of Age's stuff around, so that Age actually does some lamenting in a corner for half his speech, because Age gets this quite lengthy speech recapping the plot. There's an awful lot of recapping the plot that happens in this play, so I'm also quite curious about that structurally. It's like, just keep repeating it. For are they expecting latecomers?
Well, I mean, on one level, I wonder whether it isn't just kind of keep sort of over-eagerly reminding everyone that they're here for a moral purpose when they clearly aren't, on another level. Mm. Because, you know, the fun is to be had elsewhere. The morality is kind of the hook on which the physical comedy and the bravura acting, and just that, you know, it does feel like a show that, as you say, has grown in the performance to a point where, you know, it's more about the actors showing that they can be a plausible baby and then be a plausible knight and then be a plausible something else, than it is really about sermonizing. And they kind of have to keep remembering, oh, and this is, of course, you know, we all know that when you don't listen to Conscience, bad things happen.
Yes, because when Perseverance turns up, we do get sermonizing in a very explicit sense, when he decides to deliver the 12 articles.
And then that's when it all slows down and you suddenly think,
And there's a moment after he's finished the 12 articles and he says, "You must also hear and know the commandments 10. But he doesn't list the commandments 10, because there's a sinking feeling in this pit of everybody's stomach at that point of going, "Don't do the 10 commandments. Please don't do the 10 commandments." I wonder if there's a version where the 10 commandments are there. I do wonder.
Is, but I think they may have replaced that with just a wink or something to the audience at that point.
to be fair, I don't think the 12 articles will make the final cut of the full cast audio. It's in the spoilers episodes. There is a rough edit with all of the words, but the 12 articles, they get a name check, and then he mentions the 10 commandments, and then the play ends. That's pretty much determined in my mind. I may change my mind between now and the encounter.
Trust the text. Talking to someone who insisted we kept in 14 acts of Parliament in our production of the Lindsay's Three Estates, which did take rather longer than we thought they might. We can forever say, read them and weep, we did 14 acts of Parliament live.
That's entertainment. That's the way to go forward. I mean, as I say, there is a full uncut version of the text in the spoilers episodes, but the final edit, I do want to move it along a bit. And it's not a long play. I mean, this is the other reason why it's one of the easiest plays to stage. It is fringe theatre ready. It's about an hour, give or take, depending on how you treat it. I mean, you might make a few trims. So anyone out there, if you're looking for a play from this period that's not by John Heywood, who is also very easy to stage because most of his plays require three or four actors, this can be done with arguably two. You might need a bit of a music cue to get between Conscience and Perseverance. But apart from that, it's all very straightforwardly done. And I do really like it. And we will stage it, you know, in person rather than just as an audio production. I think fairly soon. I mean, I and I, it's also one of those plays which probably would stay in the repertoire as well, in the sense that we're trying to build a repertoire of shows that we can put on a turn of a dime, and this is a no-brainer.
I mean, it's the acoustic set that can always be played, even if the electricity's failed and half the band are stuck in transit. You can go on and do a set.
Yeah, I mean, what I've got in mind is actually that we have a makeable backing to a chair, so that we can go to any venue that's got a chair, but we can make it look a bit more impressive with some throws and some support, you know, to make it look a bit more throne-like, and then a suitcase full of costumes, and that, basically that's it. It's a suitcase show because it doesn't need any other visuals. I think possibly put some songs in as well. I think there's a drinking song that should go in, and maybe something liturgical, and you know, I think there is room for that in this text, to not just talk about cutting but also talk about expanding, because there is that sort of part in my mind that I think that this might have originally been a bigger text. That's has to be where I think, but you know, we don't have it. So if it did exist.
But it's not like one of those where there are obviously five pages at the middle missing, where, you know, adventure goes off and is replaced by...
Yes, it's not like the Four Elements where we know there's a technical presentation that goes on for four pages or something like that. You know,
and it's kind of guess what it is. I mean, we're lucky that what we've been left is an extremely interesting, playable text. And very rarely does that happen, I think.
No, I mean, without having to go, well, we need to adjust or tweak. I mean, you know, I say I'm going to cut the 12 articles, but you know, that's it. There's pretty much nothing in here. Some of the folly stuff needs careful working through, and I think it needs careful working through with business. But again, that's not so much a question of cutting. That's just more a matter of working through it. And it's more accessible, I think, than a play like, because we're talking about this as an outlier, as a morality play, but also, you know, the better known Everyman is also an outlier.
And they are all outliers.
And none of them are the same. Castle of Perseverance is this massive, enormous beast. And this is a two-hander. Miles. And they've got the same plot, basically.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's, you know, we've lost the forest and we've got six artfully placed trees around which we have to try and imagine what the forest looked like. Whereas actually what you've got are five really interesting, completely different trees that it's fun to play with.
Not just fitting it within the morality tradition, but fitting within this idea of interludes as well. Mm. You know, interlude is this sort of elastic term for anything that's a play down to a more specific kind of indoor performance. It feels indoors as well, this.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, there are a couple of references to people sitting in a row and, is the word hall used? I kind of half remember it was. So, I mean, this has to be quite an intimate audience, very close interaction all the time. You know, you can do an aside to some people and not to others. That looks to me what this is, rather than, you know, a kind of on a wagon or something. It doesn't make sense.
And that sort of also, I think, explains the way the verse is written and the irregularity of the verse is that, when you're bellowing on a street, you want something very clear cut.
Yes.
And you know how it's structured, even if you don't hear all of the words. Whereas here, it's prose, but it's written out in, I mean, yes, it's rhymed and it is doing verse things, but it is much more sayable in that sense.
And its effects are much more subtle and naturalistic in a way at times, at least. And then when they're not, they're very visibly not. So when Perseverance does, as you say, his sermonizing, we know where we are. We're at that bit.
Now, Christ, our comely creator, set all your souls into good salvation. Perseverance is my name, conscience-born brother, that is. He sent me hither, mankind, to indoctrine, that they should to no vices incline.
And it's sort of, I think in performance as well, what it says to the audience is, and this is the end of the play. We're going to do the sermon. We're all going to say amen and go. And, you know, Age turns to the audience and does a final recap and says, that was it, folks. I hope you've enjoyed this lesson. And
don't behave like I did.
Yeah. And
although, again, that sort of leaves as many questions open as...
Well, there is this sort of central problem with morality plays, is so many of them sort of condone the behaviour that they say you're not supposed to do, because they sort of say, hey, you're going to sin anyway, so off you go, get drunk, visit a sex worker, you can repent later, it's fine. So it sort of doesn't tell you not to do it, it's sort of telling you to make sure you stop doing it eventually, and it's like, make sure you're repent. And you're sort of going, is that really a moral lesson?
But I mean, this is one of the things I'm slowly and much belatedly coming to realize, I think, is that, you know, they're so much more playful, so much more assuming the audience knows where they are than that kind of notion that they're sermons. I mean, they're just not. I mean, they all say, if you die in sin, you will go to hell. This is non-negotiable. God is furious and he will punish any backsliding. They all either repent in the last 3 seconds when they've just got a chance, or they don't repent at all. And they're all saved. I mean, what kind of lesson are we teaching our children? I mean, we're not teaching our children. We're entertaining people who've already kind of got the idea that being bad is not going to get you to heaven, but then it's not going to be avoidable either. So you're going to have to negotiate those two thoughts.
And there's a thought I've been having increasingly with interludes, you know, from, you know, earlier and later, is that the important thing is understanding the event, the conventions of these kind of indoor shows, you know, where, you know, later on we'll have a much more explicit vice concept, but you know what that character is going to be doing, you know that you need to get out of the way, you know they're going to talk to the audience, you know this is going to happen, you know, and actually it's this question of, you know, how good does the play have to be as a text? Does it matter so long as it follows the rules?
And
the performers are good and do their shtick and maybe sing a good song and have some business. And actually understanding individual plays is sort of missing the point. It's like in modern theatre we have pantomime, and it's like nobody sits down and goes, I'm going to read the best pantomime script in the universe ever. You're going, no, they're all terrible and they're all brilliant, but it's the thing that matters. And yes, doing the thing
it's
matters.
The moment of performance. And I think that's, I mean, that is in a way why we don't always get the vices. I mean, as in Folly here, it's, you know, I mean, I wonder whether it's not why, I may have said this to you before, you know, the great mystery of why the goons are funny, or why the goons were funny for a certain class of an age of people. I mean, it was because they were in a culture where they'd all been educated through the war and military training. So just being silly in situations that didn't call for silliness was itself uproariously funny. And I think there's a sense of that in the vices, that some of the things they say don't make sense, but they're being silly. They're being naughty. They're being mischievous. They're inviting us to enjoy the thought that you can be silly. And that in itself is a thing, is a moment. That routine is funny. Just as, let's sing a song, you know, you can enjoy the communality and the sort of fun of just collective singing for a bit. So in a way, as long as the play gives you cues for those kind of things, the actors are happy because they can do the comedy shtick and they can do the singing and they can do the tumbling, and the audience are happy because they know where they are and they're sharing that knowledge. They're not, but you know, if you were, I don't know, anyone from the Merchant Taylor's Company to the Duke of Suffolk's house, you're sure as heck not going to give sixpence for a bunch of po-faced moralists to come into you and actually teach you not to go to hell. You'd say, well, who are you to tell me that? You're a bunch of itinerant actors with your trousers falling off. You know, they have to come in and say, we all know why we're here, share in a moment with us.
And I think
that's why they're successful.
Yes, and I think it's also why it's harder to recreate these plays today, is because they live within a context, that they exist within a matrix of every other play that is going on. And it's that's why doing lots of plays in sequence and being able to put them online and to be able to perform them potentially in seasons, so that we can almost train people to understand them,
exactly.
Not by doing a lecture or talking, you know, but just by showing the same sort of play again and again, so that people can sort of understand why they're good. Where I think in isolation, that's actually quite hard to do.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, that's why this, the kind of repertory idea that you're working with, you know, you are working with, is so important, because there is nothing like that. Working towards a living repertory of early plays, because we invariably see one play and it looks like a kind of an exotic thing, whereas every other audience that saw that play, and probably there was no audience after about 1540 in most cases, saw it as one of many plays. So they would know the routines. They would know that they would be familiar with the roles. Mm. They might even be familiar with the same company. You know, Morecambe and Wives will not be funny if you see a 2-minute skit of them in 40 years' time. Whereas if you grew up with Morecambe and Wives, then just raising your glasses is hysterically funny. And that's the same with these plays. You know, oh, it's the vice role. What's the vice going to do this time? Is it the same thing? Is it different? And they're always sort of building on that cumulative knowledge of the morality form and the way this play is slightly different to it, and yet comfortingly the same at the same time.
I think that is an excellent place for us to close this session. As we said we wouldn't be able to go on this long, and we probably have more to say, but we have to close up now. Thank you very much to my guest. Thank you for joining me once again. I hope that we will see each other in the real world with a performance of Mundus sometime soon.
Excellent, and thank you for having me back on the show, the pod, whatever it is we're calling it. It's a pleasure as always.
Thank you very much, and goodbye to the listeners at home.
Amen.